On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
A very interesting story today to be told about a real-life woman, a trained musician who became a cultural anthropologist in the field during the latter part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century. To talk to us about this amazing woman and others like her who went out west, discovered the culture of Native Americans and sought to preserve it, we're delighted to welcome to On the Bookshelf Jane Kirkpatrick. She is the New York Times and CBA best-selling and award-winning author of 40 books. She won the prestigious Wrangell Award from the Western Heritage Center for A Sweetness to the Soul. Her works have won the Willa Literary Award, the Carroll Award for Historical Fiction, and the 2016 Will Rogers Gold Medallion Award. Her new book is The Healing of Natalie Curtis. It's from Revel, a division of Baker Publishing Group. Jane divides her time between Central Oregon and California, and you can find out more about her at jkbooks.com. Jane, thank you very much for joining us today on the Bookshelf.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So you really enjoy writing about these particularly interesting people and creating a way of telling their story in the form of a novel. Is it more difficult to tell their story that way? I mean, do you have to worry about, am I being historically accurate and everything? Whereas if you were just writing a nonfiction book, all you'd have to do is the research would say, okay, this happened, so write it this way.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, both would have their challenges, but I actually liked biography. I loved reading biography as a young reader, but what a biography will tell you is what someone did and when they did it. And a novel allows you to explore why they might have done what they did and how they might have felt by doing it. And so, and for a lot of the women that I've written about who were actually, you know, lived and had lives historically, I just couldn't find enough about them. I could always find things about their husbands, their brothers, their fathers, and their sons. But a lot of the information about them as women was just not there. I mean, they didn't get interviewed by the press, and people didn't save their letters and that sort of thing. So it required that I had to find a way to fill in the blanks, and that's kind of what led me into fiction as opposed to doing strictly nonfiction.
In this particular case, this is the story of a real woman, a classically trained musician who has a breakdown right before her debut with the New York Philharmonic.
Right. She had spent her whole life, and her family was very supportive of that. They were a prominent family in New York. Her father was military and had actually assisted at the after the assassination of President Lincoln and participated in the autopsy of the president, so quite prominent. And they had all the resources to do, you know, to help her train, and they traveled in Europe, and she went to the Wagner Institutes and so on. But something happened before this debut, and she had a collapse, and it lasted for over 5 years until her brother, who had been a librarian at the New York Library, he had gone west to try to heal himself of asthma. And he did. He was feeling great. The great healer touched him, and he came back and saw his sister and said, "You need to come west."
It's interesting because there was also someone else who is kind of reborn, found his strength, was healed when he went west, and that was Theodore Roosevelt. Within a fairly close time frame of what's going on here too. This is
right. Yes, and actually, Natalie's uncle, who was deceased at the time that she was traveling in the west, had been a roommate with Theodore Roosevelt, so there were opportunities for her to kind of touch, you know, get in touch with who was then the president of the United States, who was overseeing this law that she came across and realized was really damaging for Native American people.
Now, the law was the U.S. Code of Offenses. And this has to do with what crimes would be prosecuted by the federal government on reservations, but it went beyond that, didn't it? And the more zealous Indian agents made it a crime to do anything that would allow them to maintain their cultural identity, correct?
Correct. It was, you know, it varied from reservation to reservation, but generally it was, they were not allowed to speak their language. They were not allowed to sing their songs. They were not allowed to have performances, particularly any kind of religious performances or celebrations, you know, root festivals or salmon festivals or any of that was not allowed. And the men were required and the boys were required to have their hair cut. They were not allowed to have long hair. So it was, there clearly weren't offenses in the usual sense that we would think of it, but they, different, as you say, zealous agents would, if someone was discovered singing, they could withhold rations from the entire tribe if they so chose.
So it really kind of boiled down to how the Indian agent interpreted the U.S. Code of Offenses. And I'm sure to play both sides against the middle here, I'm sure that on some level they felt like they were doing the Indians a favor by basically making them assimilate into the majority American culture, which is kind of what happened to most people who came here. Their idea was, well, if you were Irish back home, you're not Irish anymore. Don't speak Gaelic. Don't do the dances, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, and, exactly.
But what Natalie Curtis learns by actually talking to Native Americans is just because they sing and dance, it didn't mean that they were disparaging this transition they were having to make. They just, these were the songs that celebrated events in their life, ordinary day-to-day events, and just talking about them wasn't really sufficient. Am I on the right?
That's correct. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And if you think about whether it's Irish or, you know, my background is German, that part of who we are is from our ancestry. And many of, you know, or most cultural experiences, you know, we include food and music, stories that get told and brought from one generation to the next. And when all of those things were eliminated, it was, and it sort of left people, particularly Native people, bereft. They didn't have that story that's so critical for them, and the fear was that for Natalie, children would not be able to ever know what those stories were and what that music was and how important it was to, you know, harvesting the corn or the corn grinding songs and so on. And so she felt called, I really believe, to do this and to try to preserve that music for the next generation.
Now, one of the things that I liked about your book, I love history, but I'm also a musician. And I loved the fact that here's a woman who's a classically trained musician. She has a breakdown. She doesn't want anything to do with music anymore. But because of her musical training, she recognizes the pitches that these different tribes are singing. And she realizes that she might be able to write them down. She might be able to notate them and therefore preserve them.
Right. And the amazing thing to me, I mean, it's sort of, I call that these divine interventions.
Yes.
Is that the first person that she hears this music that just draws her was a woman, a Yuma woman. And here's a woman who knew Spanish and her Yuma language and English. And so here's the first musician that Natalie comes across is someone who can communicate with her, and at the same time, Natalie had the detail as a musician, you know, that sort of capacity to listen to the structure and be able to make notations of that. And I mean, I worked on a reservation for 17 years, and I went to music events and they, in the wintertime, they would have what they called medicine sings, and you would just go and they would play music that was helping to be healing. You didn't have to say where it hurt. You could just go there and listen to this music. And I couldn't tell you, I couldn't select one song from another, but Natalie could. You know, she had that ability, which is just remarkable that she should be the one that would experience that call.
This is really fascinating because in the story, she distinguishes between the different songs from the different tribes, of course, because they would be different. And the Indians get in trouble for sharing songs with her because they're not allowed to do that for any reason, even if it's and in particular, the one agent is particularly brusque with her, treating her as though she is just a meddling busybody.
Exactly.
And, and why are you bothering these people? And why are you here? And why don't you go away? You know, we don't need you here. We don't want you here. You're just making it harder for these guys because I just about trained them to quit being Indians. And then here you come along and make them want to be Indians again.
Right, right. So she had a risk. She was, her brother introduced her to some Indian activists at the time. There were some people who were very involved in Indian rights and justice and were trying to get the ear of Theodore Roosevelt. And they kind of connected with Natalie. And so they wanted her to spy in some of the schools. And she did do that, and in the process, she really realizes that what she has to do is get permission.
Yeah.
And the it's sort of like the likelihood of that is so slender, and yet she pursues the family relationship with Theodore Roosevelt and is able to get his ear about why this is important.
I think part of what's going on here, too, is that this is part of the healing of Natalie Curtis. It's not just going out west and being exposed to the clean air and all of that, although that certainly has certainly had a lot to do with her brother's healing, but it also is helping to restore her physical health. But by being exposed to these wonderful songs that no one has ever written down before and that will be lost if the Indian agents have their way, this becomes something that's part of Natalie's healing as well, isn't her emotional, her spiritual and mental healing?
Absolutely. And you know, one of the things that makes, I think, this story somewhat contemporary in nature is there's been research done by Baylor University that they have been working with the mental health of children who have been exposed or had traumatic experiences. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they've discovered is that the traditional counseling, like I was trained to do, for example, isn't as effective as music, movement, or like dance, or woodworking, or horseback riding, or, you know, crafts of some kind,
mm-hmm.
Art, and story. That those four things, and music in particular, have the capacity to bypass a part of our brain that when we've had a traumatic experience, which I believe Natalie had, that it bypasses that and goes into the part of the brain that that can receive sensory information. And so the very music that she had set aside, the Indian music, becomes then that sort of the route towards her own healing and then the healing of others that are allowed to sing if she is able to get permission for them to do that. So it's just, you know, when we think about the kind of trauma that people have today, and whether it's the pandemic or other kinds of things that have happened, how powerful music is to help us heal.
We're talking, in case you're late joining us, to Jane Kirkpatrick, who is the author of The Healing of Natalie Curtis. This is a new book out that just came out 2 months ago from Revel, a division of Baker Publishing Group. And it is a novel, but it is based on a real person. And you learned about Natalie Curtis from someone else's book, Leslie Poling Kemp's book, Ladies of the Canyon, right?
Yes, I did. And I that was like 10 years ago. I listened to her do a presentation in New Mexico, and I was just struck by this. For me, as a writer, I'm always having an unanswered question.
Mm-hmm.
And the unanswered question for this book was, how did it happen that a white woman could find herself doing this incredible work? They referred to it as ethnomusicologist. How did that happen, that she should be the one that ended up doing this, and how did that change her, and how did it change the people she came in contact with? So that was my exploration, and it's been a fascinating journey. I probably had more material about Natalie than I've had about a lot of the women that I've written. But it's then you have to sort out what you can put in the novel and what you have to leave out.
Right, right. Well, one of the things that fascinated me was her use of technology. Her new technology of recording devices that was invented by, at least the one that she's using, invented by Thomas Alva Edison, and it was the cylinder recorder.
Yeah.
I actually have one of those, non-working, unfortunately, that I inherited from my grandmother, who was born in 1900. And and apparently it was the baby of the bunch and ended up with some of the cool stuff. And they brought that over from Norway, apparently.
Interesting.
And so her using the cylinder recorder, it would be just like in our day, if we're carrying around a cell phone and using it to record, and the Indians had never seen anything like this wax cylinder recorder. But I would imagine most of the Indian agents probably hadn't seen too many of them out west either.
I think that's true. And also she, in some ways, because she played some classical music, she had some cylinders of classical music, and I think she kind of disarmed some of the agents, and of course, especially after she was able to have permission to do it, I think they probably did find it fascinating that here she was, and a number of the native people themselves started getting to hear themselves, and we all sort of have an interest in, it's why we do selfies, I guess.
Right.
It was the early selfie for them.
Now, as far as Natalie Curtis, did she ever go back to much performing? There's a wonderful scene in here where she asks a tribe to sing for her, and then she sings, and she would sing something for them. So she sang something Wagnerian, as I recall, that was very dramatic, and they responded and sang for her. And she certainly still had the gift of making music. Did she ever? Did she take these presentations, these recordings, and play them in any sort of public venue, or was this primarily just to record to save them?
She did record some of them and play them. She played them for Theodore Roosevelt had a luncheon, for example, that included a number of senators and representatives, and she sang for them. It was one of the first times she had sung in a long time. And she sang the Indian songs, and she also played some of those recordings. And then she made some of them available to fairly well-known conductors of, major orchestras. And a couple of them were incorporated, a couple of the recordings were incorporated into compositions that others did. To my knowledge, she never performed professionally again, other than, for... She sang at a funeral of a friend and that sort of thing. And I think she probably did play those when she did presentations, because she began to travel around the world to talk about the importance of preserving culture and particularly to music. And so she did use the recordings in that regard, but I don't think she ever, stood up in front of that New York Philharmonic that she did. I don't think she ever went back to that at all.
The Hopi Indians called the white people, Anglos, Pahana.
Right.
But they also called her a really cool name. Is it Ta'amana?
That's how I pronounced it, yes. And it was song maiden. It meant, that that's who she was for them. It was just the preserver of songs and the incorporator of songs. She was, from everything I could find, and particularly in reading the book that she eventually wrote and published, and she described herself as the editor of it. This is sort of remarkable, that every person that she recorded, every Native person she recorded or whose story she used in the book, she attributed that to that person. And so even at the very, 100-some years ago, she understood integrity and intellectual property rights, I think, and understood the importance of people having their name attributed in this work, this book that she wrote. And I think that's really quite remarkable that she didn't appropriate. She wanted to record it and preserve it, but she also wanted it to be attached to the person who had shared it with her.
Yeah. I think that's pretty remarkable. As a matter of fact, later in the book, she does finally get the book published. It's about 3 pounds.
I know. I weighed it. I have a copy of it, and weighed it. And
wow!
You don't want to read it. You don't want to read it at night because if you fall asleep, it's going to fall on your nose and break it. It's a fat book.
That is amazing. And there's something that we really haven't talked very much about. We've alluded to it a few times. That Revel is a Christian publisher, and Natalie Curtis. Part of the restoration, part of her healing was emotional, certainly, and psychological, but it was also spiritual healing, that she returned to her faith, and her faith deepened because of the fact that even though she was being recording the songs of Native Americans who certainly weren't talking about a triune God, nonetheless, this work that she felt like that God was putting her in these positions to do this great work on behalf of all of these people, to give them a voice for those who had lost their voice.
Correct. I noticed in the book there are several examples where she's recorded questions that she asked and of the various leaders and that she got to know, and I was intrigued that many of those questions were about how they saw divinity, how they saw and what they might have been able to share in that regard. So she understood the importance of music for spiritual development and really was curious and wanting to sort of look at how parallel that was or how that might have fit into Anglo experiences with God and with Jesus. And so there were questions that she asked, and it was very interesting. I know one of a reviewer had said, well, as I had written about her, that I had suggested that she thought that the God she worshipped was the same as the God that the Indians worshipped, and this particular reviewer didn't believe that to be the case. And I found her, I didn't think that Natalie was saying anything more than wanting to understand how they saw divinity and what sort of threads could be shared between that and a Christian faith.
So what happened to Natalie Curtis, the Natalie Curtis you write about, this real woman? This is taking place in the book is between like 1897 or so and 1915, yes. Right?
Right. And she does marry, and her parents are like wondering if she ever will. And she's actually, and her brother eventually marries too. But the other siblings, there are 4 other siblings who never married, never left home. They just stayed at their parents' home in New York. So she and George were the only ones who sort of left the nest. And she married a man who was several years younger, but he was an artist from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And they had a very short marriage together. I think it was probably 5 or 6 years. And Natalie was in Paris, France, and she had just spoken at the Sorbonne in Paris about this book and about the importance of cultural preservation and the music and so on. And it was a rainy night, and she stepped off the bus, and a doctor who was hurrying to an emergency never saw her. And he struck her, and she never regained consciousness. Oh. So she was only in her 40s. I don't have that in the book, Dave. I have that in the author's notes.
Right, yes.
I wanted the reader to enjoy and celebrate this, and it was. It was a celebration of a life that had been lost, that was returned, and it was returned by caring about and paying attention to the stories of Native people. And to me, that was You know, he lived a full life, even though it was a short life.
Yeah. Wow. What an astonishing legacy that she presented to not just American readers, but to the world.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Yes.
Amazing.
And there was a celebration for her on All Saints Day in Paris. And so there were, you know, as you say, around the world, people knew of her, and they had remembered her as a Wagnerian, you know, specialist. But her final days were certainly as a Native American supporter and encourager and a celebratory music related to that part of her life, which was very different from the early part.
Marvelous. Well, I know people can check you out on Facebook, the author Jane Kirkpatrick, on BookBub and Goodreads. They can find more about you at jkbooks.com. Is there any other way? I don't think you want to give them your telephone number.
Okay, but there is a Facebook group called Books and Beyond that is Revel supported, and it's a very nice conversation about books, and authors participate and respond, and they have chosen for this month in November the healing of Natalie Curtis. So if people want to check that out, they could have conversations and answer questions, and I'll be visiting there quite often.
Lovely.
And hopefully loading some videos technologically. I figure if Natalie can manage an Edison machine, maybe how to do a video and get it up there.
That's the spirit.
Exactly.
Jane, thank you for making time to talk about this remarkable woman and about the fact that she was not the only one doing this, and yet we don't ever hear about this. So thank you for bringing that to your readers' attention, and I hope the book is a huge success because it is absolutely a fascinating story.
Thank you. I really appreciate your spending the time with me to talk about it. So thank you so much.
My great pleasure. And once again, our guest today is author Jane Kirkpatrick. Her new book, The Healing of Natalie Curtis, from Revel Books, a division of Baker Publishing Group. It is a novel, but it's based on a real person, and quite an amazing person at that. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and on your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbeam.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.